ready.
Welcome to Let's Talk Land, a weekly land education talk show devoted to learning about land and farms, buying and selling, and ownership, especially for real estate agents and realtors. Learn from the experts. Free land education. Hi, my name's Lou Jewell. I'm an accredited land consultant with United Country Real Estate, Sutton Properties, our new company name, along with my co-host today, Teresa Martin, who unfortunately went home feeling not good today, so we'll miss you, Teresa. You can listen to us. As one of our agents buying and selling homes, land or farms, or you want to auction your property in Western North Carolina or Southern Virginia, just give us a shout. We'll help you out. Our new office is at 102 East Main Street next to BB&T Bank in downtown Pilot Mountain, North Carolina. Please make a note of our changes. Our new company website is www.allsuttonproperties.com. Just a program note, Dr. Barbie's Ask the Doctor show will now follow this show and will air at 10 a.m., so make sure you stay tuned. Dr. Barbie always has something good to tell you. Our guest today is John Leeser. Welcome, John.
Hello. How are you doing, Lou?
You're all the way in Toulon, Illinois. Where's Toulon?
Toulon's in central Illinois, near Peoria, Illinois.
Okay. Is that kind of rolling farmland out there?
This is a very rich farming community.
Is it like the richest one?
Well, I don't know if it's the richest one, but it's very good land right in central Illinois.
Wow. And most of the crops are what's corn and wheat?
Corn and soybeans would be
and
the
soybeans.
Crops.
Yep. Okay. So you're an accredited land consultant. We're both members of the wonderful Realtors Land Institute that's, I believe, about 77 years old. We're part of the National Association. We have about 1,300 members nationwide, realtors, and we have a designation that's awarded to us after we meet all the requirements called the Accredited Land Consultant Designation, and you and I are one of maybe 500 in the country right now. You also achieved your Graduates Realtor Institute, the GRI designation, and you're also insurance licensed and got your CIC for the John Leeser Farmland and Sell and Leeser Insurance Agency in, again, Toulon, Illinois. And what's interesting is your dad, Dick, was a real estate agent and got his license and opened up a firm back in 1970 in downtown and became the secretary and treasurer of the Elmira Mutual Country Fire Insurance Company, along with his duty as owner and agency manager of the Luzerne Insurance Agency. And then in 2011, your son Ben joined the agency. Good for him. So you're three generations.
Yeah, that's we're very proud of that legacy there.
My dad was in real estate. He died when I was 18 in Charlotte. And, of course, I have my license, and my daughter and son-in-law have theirs. So we're on a three-generation roll as well.
Good for you.
Yes, sir. It's real important. Yeah. So you're also, we have, I believe, 18 chapters, Realtors Land Institute chapters around the United States. And you happen to be the president of the Illinois chapter. Tell us about your chapter. How many members and how often you get together and what do you guys do?
Okay, so, yeah, thanks, Lou. I've been a member of the Illinois chapter of the RLI for quite a few years and served on the board for probably 5 or 6 years. Worked my way through the various officers' positions. And so last fall I took over as the president of Illinois chapter, which is a two-year term. So just getting a good start in that. We have about 96 members in our chapter. It's a pretty active chapter. We meet. We have a number of education programs throughout the year. We have an annual meeting in the fall. We have a land education day. We have one coming up in. We have a land values day coming up in April, and along with the Illinois Society of Farm Managers and Rural Appraisers, in conjunction with them, we publish a book every year called the Land Values Book. For Illinois. So a lot of stuff going on here.
I believe you're one of the first chapters to do that. You remember what year your chapter was established? I know you're one of the older ones in our association.
I don't. We've been in, our chapter's been in effect long before I was in the business, which
right.
I've been in 37 years. So
right.
It goes back a ways.
Yeah, it does. It's quite one of the best chapters in our association. And got a great leader, and I'm sure you've got a great board to help you out. I had the honor, actually, I joined RLI in 98 and or 98 is when I joined, and I've been the president of our used to be North Carolina chapter, 33, and then we merged with South Carolina and became the Carolinas chapter. In 2007, I was president again for that, and I've been on the board every year, believe it or not, except for one. So,
yeah, good for you.
It's quite a group of landmen and landladies. We're real proud of our land people out there. And you know, for the listening audience out there, you know, if you're buying and selling land, you definitely want to try to find a member of the Realtors Land Institute. And you can do that real easy by going to our website, www.rliland.com. We have 10 two-day educational programs, 16 hours, that are tested, and $10 million in sales and final test and approved by one of the ALCs, fellow ALCs, and then it goes to our board for recognition and designation awards. So when did you get your ALC, John?
I've had my ALC for about 8 years now.
Right. How do you think RLI has helped you in your business?
Oh, it's helped me tremendously. We have land contracts that are specific to land that are vetted by our members, or who are all land professionals, and then reviewed by an attorney. And so that gives us a lot better resources than what, you know, our local multiple listing service or Realtors Association can give, because this is really specific to land. You know, I think it's important to note, like you said, you know, land is a totally different animal than, say, residential real estate. And I have a lot of great friends that are fantastic at what they do in residential real estate. But really, when you're selling land, you need somebody with experience in that, because it's altogether different than selling a house.
That's true. And, you know, talking about education, it's really, well, it's what it is. But there's no land education, really, when we take – how many hours do you have to get your license in your state? Pre-licensing.
Sorry, what was that, Luke?
How many hours for pre-licensing in your state? We have 100.
I think it's 40 hours now.
Okay, we have 180. With the federal test and a state test, and then that you become a provisional broker in North Carolina, and then you have three more 30-hour classes, and those are also tested. You have to pass to get your broker's license. So
yeah.
But in all those syllabus, I don't think they spend maybe 10 minutes on the subject of land, and I'm almost to my 100th hour of radio talk shows, Let's Talk Land. And we're still touching the surface of all the different things that's involved in a land transaction.
Sure, yep.
So,
and I think the you know, out of all the realtors in our association, there's only a very few percentage-wise that really specialize in land. So, you know, there's, and I think that's why, as you said in the classes, they touch very little on land, because the majority of the folks going into it are going to be residential.
Well, statistics say there's about 98% of the 1.4 million realtors. Now, there's real estate agents. They're not associated with the National Association of Realtors or members of MLS. You know, they're independents, and that's fine. There's room for them, too. So, for example, in North Carolina, I think we just went over 111,000 realist licensed agents in the state, of which there's about 48,000 active realtors in that group. A lot of people, they get their license and they don't practice because it's so hard to get. So as long as they send their $45 in, and by the end of June every year, you know, they stay on an inactive status and have to take CE classes in order to reactivate their license. So there's a lot of part-timers out there. And then in our continuing education, we have to have 8 hours in North Carolina every year to keep your license active. And 4 hours of those are required, which is updates in the laws and updates in the forms. And I'm happy to be on the Commercial Forms Committee, have been since 2008. We create the commercial forms. We have a residential form committee as well. And then you have to, of those elective, there's over 300 titles, John, and I am the only land instructor with the only certified land class for CE credit in the state of North Carolina. Which sounds crazy.
Good.
And I guarantee if you call up your Illinois Real Estate Commission and say, we'd like to take a class, elective class for CE credits on the subject of land, I bet you they don't tell you they don't have one, because I cannot find a state in the United States that offers a land CE class other than the one I teach in North Carolina.
Oh, Right. Other than maybe an elective here and there, right?
Right. And then, of course, I teach the LAM 101 class that came out in 2003. It's one of our 10 courses. That's a two-day, 16-hour course. So chapters like yours hire me to teach. I hope you guys would hire me. I'd love to come out there, teach that class for you sometime. I just got back from the last November. I went to the Oklahoma chapter down to Tulsa, and we had a great time. We had some of the best guys and gals. We have a lot of fun in my classes, a lot of information, but a lot of fun. So, but anyway, that's the history on RLI and land brokerage. So make sure, listening audience, if you're interested in buying or selling or just learning about land, you can listen to our show. But make sure you try to find a RLI member, www.rliland.com. This show is dedicated to the Realtors Land Institute and trying to help folks out there. So, John, I wanted, you know, you've got two designations. You've got the real estate side, but most interesting, you also have the lineage with your family with the insurance side. And when we were talking before the show, I suggested that maybe the topic today is something that we haven't had on our show, is farm insurance. How would you like to tell us about farm insurance today?
Sure. Well, you know, as Lou, as you said in the intro, that my dad started the agency back in 1970. So here this year in 2020, we're celebrating 50 years in business under our family. So we're pretty proud of that.
Absolutely.
Dad originally farmed, and when I was born, we lived on the farm. I spent my first 5 years on the farm before we moved off the farm when he went into business. And, you know, the old saying, you can take the boy off the farm, but you can't take the farm out of the boy.
I've heard that.
Growing up, I always was interested in farming, and I guess that's, you know, probably got that small taste of it in the first 5 years of my life. So, and of course, Dad was interested in farming. So, in our business here with both the insurance agency and the real estate agency, we've always been focused on ag real estate and ag insurance, although we do other types of insurance too, but ag is really our biggest one. So, you know, when we're talking about farm insurance, you know, it, just like an accredited land consultant, it's important to have a insurance agent that understands farming, because there's a lot of licensed insurance agents around, but not all of them know anything about farming. I have a list of things that I like to talk with my customers about. And naturally, you know, when you own a farm, you operate a farm, oftentimes there's a farmhouse, so you live on the farm. You have farm buildings, grain bin, grain storage facilities, machine sheds, livestock buildings. And, you know, I think it's very obvious. Everybody knows those really need to be insured, as well as a liability policy, a farm liability policy for your farming operation, and auto insurance for your semis and car trucks and so forth. But there's some things that are oftentimes overlooked and that people don't think about. Now, that's what I just wanted to cover today, if that's all right, Lou.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So, you know, one thing is a big exposure on the farm is pollution exposure. So, you know, and most people don't even think about it, but farms, you know, they have large amounts of clean diesel fuel on hand, and they also are handling chemicals. And so, the you know, the chemicals are both stored in the buildings as well as being transported up down the roads in the pickup trucks and in the sprayer. And, you know, with the EPA, the way things are today, if there's an accident and those pollutants seep into the ground, they could seep into the ground on the farm premises, or they could have an accident off the premises and seep into, say, the township road or the neighbor's property. So that's considered farm pollution exposure and farm pollution liability. Now, not every farm policy, and by the way, Lou, I'm in Illinois, as you know, and so there's different laws in different states, and different insurance companies do things differently. So I'm just going to be talking about things in general, the way we see them, but they could vary from state to state and insurance company. So,
John, let's pick up on this. Our guest today is John Leeser. This is Let's Talk Land. So, John, tell us more about farm insurance. This is fascinating, especially chemicals. I didn't think about that. That's I mean, I guess.
Yeah, that's why I bring it up, and I, you know, venture to guess that a lot of folks that are handling this stuff maybe haven't thought through some of the ramifications of it. You know, so as I mentioned, you know, you could be transporting chemicals in your automobiles, in your farm pickup trucks or semis, or you could be transporting them in your farm implements. And those are covered in different ways. So it's important for the farm operator, when he meets with his insurance carrier, to discuss both exposures there. If he has pollution liability coverage for his farming operations, in other words, with his machinery, and pollution exposure coverage for his automobiles, because it is two different coverages.
John, let me ask you a question. You know, 50 years of experience, I mean, this whole thing has changed, right? And 50 years ago, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
You're correct. We wouldn't be having this, right.
When did this kind of come about?
Well, this has been around for a long time. You know, if you kind of look at what the history of the EPA might be, you know, I'd say at least 25 years ago they started tightening up with the laws and the regulations and the enforcement of it. So, as things in the world change, so does the insurance industry.
Sure, it has to
try to address those.
So is it with the relaxation of some of the EPA laws over the board, did they relax any in the farming industry, or is it tightened up, or is it about the same?
In the last 30 to 40 years, it's about the same.
Okay.
Certainly, I don't think it's relaxed any.
Right. So what else, what other type of coverage, if I'm wanting to buy a farm and invest in a farm, would I be looking for coverage?
All right. Another thing to be aware of, with the diversifications of farms today, a lot of farms are doing sideline businesses, incidental businesses, along with the farming operation. Things like trucking for hire, seed sales, custom spraying, possibly doing some kind of a construction or welding repair shop type of operation. So as farms change and take on some more of these type of exposures, they really need to be aware of updating their insurance, because a farm liability policy is designed for just that, farming, which is usually defined as the, you know, the raising of crops and livestock.
Right.
Once you start diversifying into more businesses, probably your farm insurance, no doubt your farm insurance needs to be updated to address those exposures. Otherwise, you might find that you're not covered for some of those things.
So you really need to meet with your insurance agent probably at least once a year, right? Kind of say what's going on. You guys circulate around with your clients and help them out.
Absolutely. It's important to keep them updated. And the size of the operation, you know, probably the bigger the operation and the more complex it is, would need to be meet with their agent more often, just because they have more issues to deal with.
Right. So there are other types of insurance too. What's the history? I know after the Dust Bowl and the Depression, I think it was like around 1938, Congress passed the Federal Crop Insurance Act, which established the first crop insurance program.
You know, here in Central Illinois, crop insurance is a big part of the operation. It's a fantastic safety net. There's, you know, two main types of crop insurance. One is a federally subsidized crop insurance, usually referred to as multi-peril crop insurance, and that is subsidized by the USDA. The RMA is the Risk Management Agency, which is a arm of the USDA, manages that. So under that program, it's all standardized. So the insurance companies contract with the RMA to provide the service to the growers, to the farmers.
Okay.
But they're all doing it under the authority of the RMA. So in that case, that being said, the cost and the coverage is identical no matter what insurance company you get it from.
So a 100-acre corn crop farmer in the northern part of the state or other states possibly, they're going to be getting basically the same policy and same coverage, same cost?
Yeah, well, there's course, there's a variety of options available, but assuming that they chose the same options with company insurance company A and the same option with insurance company B, it would be identical coverage. So really, you know, when people are deciding where to buy their crop insurance, their federal crop insurance, you know, it's all service driven.
Right.
They're going to gravitate to the companies that are providing the best service because the price and the coverages are all standardized.
So they updated the Federal Crop Insurance Act somewhere around 1980, right? They increased the participation levels, I guess.
Yeah, so they actually, it started out as strictly a federal crop insurance program, so the growers, the farmers were buying it directly from the federal government, and it proved to be not very efficient. And so when the USDA partnered with the private insurance industry, so the insurance industry was in charge of servicing the policies.
Right.
So, advising the farmers on what's available, helping them with their purchase decisions, helping them through the claims process, all that stuff was being handed off to the private sector, with still the government subsidizing the cost and doing the actuarial and, deciding on the parameters of coverage. So that really increased the participation in the program when that happened.
Right. So the insurance companies and the agents, they're the boots on the ground, right?
They're the boots on the ground. You're exactly right. Yep.
So in 94, they reconstructed the program. And then again in 96, I think they created the risk management agency?
Yes.
And what was that for?
Well, the risk management agency, RMA for short, and they're just an arm of the USDA. That's all they do. They're focused on administrating this crop insurance program. So the RMA, the consumer, the farmer, the growers, however you want to describe them, they really don't have to interact with the RMA. That's all done from the RMA to the insurance companies.
Right.
And then the insurance companies deal directly with the farmers.
I was just picking something out of Wikipedia, and I swear I'm getting some of this information. But it seems like in 2011, the farmers purchased over 2 million crop insurance policies and protecting over 265 million acres of farmland with liabilities of $1.14 billion. They also covered roughly 80% of the eligible acres. I guess that's nationwide. Record indemnities that were paid out to farmers in 2011 totaling $11 billion, I guess, for hail damage and floods and all the things that happen, wind damage to crops to keep the farmers healthy and whole.
Yeah.
So it's strictly a risk-based insurance. Are you seeing more claims as the weather patterns are changing some?
Well, of course, in Illinois, 2019 was a very challenging year for our farmers here. We had an extremely wet spring. And so for the first time ever in my career, we saw prevented planting claims. That's where the producers are prevented from planting due to weather conditions.
Right.
And so there's, you know, fairly good amount of prevented planting claims. Again, the first time I've ever seen it in 37 years.
Hmm.
And then that was followed. So the folks that did get them planted, for the most part, were late. And so that wasn't good. And then we had a pretty hot, dry spell in the middle of the summer. So a very challenging year for farmers. And so we saw a lot more claims this year than what we had in the last, say, 3 years.
And this is different than the CRP program, right?
Different than the CRP program,
Yeah, where farmers are paid not to grow certain acreages or reduce their production.
Yeah.
And that keeps the commodity market, I guess the purpose of that is to help keep the commodities market more stable.
Yeah, because it takes some of the ground out of production. It also is a good conservation practice.
Right.
They like to have CRP acres, you know, buffering creeks and rivers and stuff to keep the erosion from washing into the streams.
So now there's some crop yield insurance, and there's two classes of that. Tell us about that.
Okay, so there's one that's called YP, or yield protection for short. So,
okay.
It's really only covering the production of the crop. So if the crop doesn't produce above the yield guarantee, then that triggers a claim. So, and then the counterpart to that then is called revenue insurance. Okay, so revenue insurance really insures dollars, not yield. So we use yield to get to the dollars.
Okay.
But we have the yield guarantee times the base price per acre gives you the dollars of coverage. So if you have low yields or drop in commodity prices or a combination of the two, any one of those or the combination could cause your revenue off your crop to drop below the guarantee, which would trigger a claim. So the yield protection is strictly based on drop in bushels, and the revenue protection can be drop in bushels or drop in commodity prices.
So if you have a loss, you can look at it two different ways. Is that what you're saying?
Well, you can take one of these or the other.
Okay, I got you.
You can choose to only insure the yield risk, or you can choose to insure the yield and the price risk, price fluctuation risk.
I want to try to get a dollar figure in my head, and I'm not real sure how to ask the question, but is this a percentage? Is insurance usually a percentage of the gross income on farm production? How do you equate the money?
Okay, that's a great question. So in either case, in the yield coverage or the revenue coverage, you buy a percentage of your expected production. So an 85% is the highest level you can get on corn. So if you had a 10-year average yield, which we call APH. APH stands for actual production history.
Okay.
So if your APH was 200 bushels per acre and you bought an 85% plan, take the 200 times 85%, so then that's 170 bushel guarantee. So then if, in that case, on a yield-only plan, if your yield dropped below 170 bushels, that would trigger a claim, and that would make up the shortfall up to the 170 bushels.
And that's going to be different with different types of the what they call the standard crops, the cotton, the soybeans, the wheat.
It's same theory or same basic parameters for all types of crops, but some are by pounds, some of them are by bushels, and so forth.
Right, but there's also different coverages. I'm seeing here crop insurance: 87% cotton, 96% soybeans, 88% for wheat. I think maybe something like that. So the crops are evaluated a little bit different, right, in terms of coverage?
A little bit different, yeah.
Yeah, okay. That was my point. So, again, back to my question, if you look at what this costs, if I'm a farmer and I'm just starting out and I'm running my budget, okay, and I got to allocate so many dollars to my 100-acre corn crop that I'm projecting to create for this year, what kind of percentage is my, and I'm sure that would vary. I'm not talking about the house. And just to say it's vacant land with no improvements, okay? Keep it simple. What kind of percentage?
Yeah, so are you talking about what the crop insurance costs? Is that what your question
Yeah,
is?
John. Yeah, I'm trying to get a handle.
Okay. So it's going to run in the neighborhood, the federal crop insurance policy revenue plan is going to run in the neighborhood of 2% of the revenue.
Okay.
So if you had expected revenue of $750 per acre, 2% of that's $15 an acre.
Gotcha.
That's a good rule of thumb to get you in the ballpark.
Okay, all right.
And of course, this is government subsidized. This insurance is government subsidized. So the 2% I'm talking about is the actual cost out of pocket for the farm producer.
So is there a different insurance that would be cheaper or more expensive?
Okay, so
for the same coverage.
Federal crop insurance, multiple crop insurance, it covers all types of natural causes of loss. So it could be drought, could be early frost, could be excess moisture, flooding, wind, hail,
insects,
all those types of things.
Yep.
It really is not a private product that does all that would be any cheaper because, remember the government is subsidizing this, so there's no way a private company could compete with this and give a more competitive product because they don't have that subsidy.
Gotcha. Hey, we're talking to John Leeser, and this is Let's Talk Land. So, John, we're talking about farm insurance, and one of the things I'm curious about is we've talked about the basic crops, you know, the corn, the wheat, the soybeans, and cotton, and that's the base crops that the USDA recognizes. But then there's specialty crops. And, for example, you know, here in North Carolina, we 2 years ago approved hemp farming. Do you guys have that in your state?
We just got started on hemp in Illinois. Was approved in 2019 for the first time.
And I think you got marijuana approved for this coming this year, right?
In 2020, recreational marijuana. We've had medical marijuana for several years, but just approved recreational marijuana in Illinois starting January 1st of 2020.
Right. So I've done three shows on hemp and marijuana. I've done our buddy out in Colorado that teaches. And who's been involved in it since the 80s, and I did one of my ALC buddies in a neighboring county. He got the first license in Wilkes County, North Carolina, a couple years ago. And then I had the Papa Bear Farm, had two shows for them, one on hemp growing, one on soils, which is real important too. So, but they mentioned that there was no crop insurance for their products. Is that, where are we with that?
So they just approved a product for hemp in and it's a pilot program. This is a federal crop insurance program administrated by the RMA, which is an arm of the USDA. It's a pilot program. It's not available in all states. I know it is Illinois. I don't have a list of all the states in front of me, but Illinois is one of them.
Where would someone go to find out if their state was approved?
You could call your crop insurance agent,
okay,
or you could go on the RMA website, risk management.
The national RMA website, okay.
So, you know, the hemp, it's brand new, and actually everybody's really just learning about it, but it's a pretty narrow program. It has a lot of rules, one of which is you're not eligible to purchase it unless you have at least 1 year experience growing hemp. So the new producers are not going to be able to insure their crop until they've had a year of experience with
it.
That's something that we've never seen before in say, the traditional crops.
Sure. Just I think
one of the big risks in growing hemp is the regulators. It's not allowed to have over 0.3% THC.
Right.
In hemp. Now, and I don't know if you know, THC is the chemical which it would be in marijuana that causes you to get high. So when you're growing hemp for whether it's CBD oil, fiber, or for seed. It's not a lot, but the regulations don't allow that to be tested. If it is tested with more than 0.3% THC in it, the crop has to be destroyed.
And I'm sure that's probably not insured if it was destroyed.
That is not insured. You're exactly right. And that's one of the biggest risks that folks are looking to try to protect themselves.
Sure.
Because it's extremely expensive to produce, to plant and produce. Hemp.
And then destroy it. And that's a good incentive, too, you know, to make sure it's a checks and balances, too. So.
Right. And it's a new, you know, it's not a mature industry, so the standardization and safeguards really aren't well in place with regulating the purity of the seed and so forth like that. So a lot of risk with that.
Going back in insurance history, I got a question for you, John. We're talking about this pilot program for hemp. Go back in history. What was another crop that went through something similar? Is there anything that relates to that?
Like
hydroponic tomatoes or something.
Yeah, those are specialty crops that are not, you know, widely grown. And you know, being from Illinois, they're not commercially grown too much around here. So a lot of those you have to have a written agreement to insure with the RMA. So if there's no program, a widely utilized program with the RMA, you can go to the RMA and ask for a written agreement to do some of those specialty crops on a you know, one-time basis.
So if I'm growing like mushrooms or truffles, you know, I've helped several farmers around here start truffle farms over the years.
Is that right? Okay. Yeah.
And I know one of them was able to get some insurance after proving that he knew what he was doing. I think it took a couple years, but he finally got underwritten.
Yeah, so. I mean, you got to be willing to go jump through some hoops to get sure. some of those specialty crops covered. Yeah.
Have you had any experience in that, John, in your career or your family?
No, I really haven't. Corn and soybeans and wheat are
pretty straightforward.
Probably 99% of the crops, you know, in my area. So, but we're just getting starting on hemp. So.
Right. And I would say this insurance probably is going to be more expensive, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Because you got more risk.
The options are not near as many options, more expensive, more rules. So they're going into it very cautious, I'd say.
Yeah, and that's fine. That makes sense. I mean, it's that's what it's all based on, right?
Yep, yep.
Now, something we haven't talked about, too, is livestock. Now, that's another hole. That's for your cattle industry. Does it also include the horse industry and the llama industry and, you know, some of these people getting some crazy stuff, emus and ostriches.
Yeah. So, you know, some of the things, you know, livestock growers, the cattle growers, a couple of things for them to be aware of that maybe are easily overlooked. They can have a lot of money wrapped up in semen and embryos. I mean, it wouldn't be uncommon for them to have $50,000 or $100,000 worth of that stuff. And they store those in these semen tanks, right. which are liquid nitrogen. And naturally, if there's a fire or a tornado, those could be destroyed. But a big risk is if the tank leaks. That I don't know if you're familiar with that, Lou. You have a tank of liquid nitrogen, and the semen and embryos are suspended into it. If the nitrogen leaks out of the tank, then the refrigeration is gone,
right?
And all that spoils. So that's a large exposure there that is very easily overlooked until it happens.
So the basic livestock insurance really deals with cows, and then you got these wraparounds and specialty animals like we talked about, crops, right?
Right. So like a commercial herd of cattle, you know, you're just going to insure that on a farm blanket, and it's going to be covered for a lot of perils, you know, getting damaged while in transit. Lightning is a big thing when they're out in the pasture.
Right.
You know, they're out there and they can get struck by lightning. They can drown. They can be vandalism, accidental shooting, attack by wild animals. So all those things are covered, like, on a herd basis. When you get into the expensive breeding stock, then, you know, we're looking at doing livestock mortality, which is, you might as well call it life insurance for animals, because it would insure from any cause of death.
Sure. I mean, if you got a $1 million horse, you want to have it covered, right?
Exactly, right. You can't take the chance of disease or injury.
Or a trophy bull, or, you know.
Yeah, right.
So why does a farm need insurance? It's kind of a
why does a farm need insurance? Well, there's a lot of risks out there. You know, farming is one of the most hazardous occupations there are. And so, you know, they've got a lot of money wrapped up in machinery, a lot of money wrapped up in livestock, farm buildings, grain storage facilities, livestock buildings, machinery, shops. And you have risks all over the place, fire, windstorm, not to mention driving that huge machinery down the road to get from one farm to another. Tremendous amount of liability out there in traffic, hitting a school bus with 60 kids on it would be the, you know, that's the type of thing to keep me up at night. But,
yeah, I bet.
So farms are faced with all these risks, and then we haven't even talked about, you know, an injury to a farm employee, and that's a whole topic on its own. And that you know, the regulations for injuries to employees would vary from one state to the other.
Sure.
In Illinois, a farm operation is exempt from being required to buy work comp. They're exempt until they get up to, rule of thumb is about 4 to 4.5 full-time employees before they're required to buy work comp.
Okay.
So they have to keep a track of that, too.
So some of the other perils, like sinkholes collapsing and volcanic action or earthquake loss or flood, you know, these are some unique perils, but I'm sure all that's covered, right, in your base policies?
Yeah, So earthquake would be an optional coverage. You can, if you're in an area that's prone to earthquakes, naturally you'd want to put it on your policy. If you're not in an earthquake zone, you still can if you want to. That's a business decision what people would choose to or not. Some of the things, you know, as we talked about earlier in the first session, you know, the world changes, and every time it changes, it brings up new risks. So one of the things evolving now is the use of drones. You got farmers using drones out there.
Okay, didn't think about that. Sure.
Yeah. So and that's another thing that's overlooked. You know, aircraft. A drone is an aircraft.
Right.
And a farm liability policy has an exclusion for aircraft. So, which means that if you don't have it, if you don't have an endorsement on there, or if you haven't made arrangements with an insurance company to cover this drone, you're going to be flying that without any liability protection. So. Naturally, the drones, you know, the ones that are used for scouting fields, you know, they weigh maybe 2 or 3 pounds, and a lot of people don't even think, and they're being operated in rural areas, but there's still quite a bit of liability associated with a drone. You know, we have crop dusters around here.
Okay.
That are spraying crops with helicopters and airplanes. So if you're out there flying the drone over your field and the neighbor's got somebody crop dusting his crops, and your drone gets tangled up with that crop duster airplane and causes it to go down, you've got a big problem on your hands.
I'd say.
Yep. Wow. The other thing, you know, the drones can take off on you. They're supposed to have a homing device where they come back, but technology can fail.
Exactly.
If it went down on the highway and caused an auto accident, you know, those are serious things. And so I know people buy drones and probably buying insurance is the last thing they think about, but that's something they need to be aware of.
So what's not covered under farm insurance? I've just seen a couple things in my notes here, like freezing or blizzards or snowstorms.
So with livestock, especially livestock in the open, smothering from freezing is never really going to be covered. Livestock confinements, that's another big issue. Mostly hog confinements, but you know they have to have ventilation through those buildings, or else because of the sewer gases, the manure gases in the pit below,
right?
Well, that'll cause the hogs to suffocate if the fans go off, the ventilation goes off. So suffocation that's a big risk. The suffocation is going to be they're all going to die, or none of them are going to die for
right.
the most part.
Yeah.
You're not going to have one
sure.
die of suffocation. So. When you have a suffocation loss, that's a huge loss. And that isn't covered automatically. You have to have an additional endorsement on your policy for that.
Gotcha. And, you know, in our area, we're big in chicken farming and turkey farming.
Chicken. Okay, sure.
So, you know.
Do they have a suffocation exposure with the chicken farms? We don't have any around here.
I'm sure they do. I don't know. But I would think
yeah.
that they would because, you know, those things are housed in buildings. And like you said, something goes out, and
yeah.
you got a 100-degree temperature, and then 90%
yeah.
humidity, and you know, and you got 10,000 birds in the building, you know,
yeah.
all huddled up together, creating their own heat.
One of the other things we see a lot around here is custom feeding operations. So, the farm owner will put up the hog barns, but they're not his hogs in there. He's being paid a fee to feed them, to raise them.
Right,
and. You know, when he has other people's hogs under his care, that's a unique liability exposure as well. Because if he does something negligent that causes those hogs to die, he's going to have a lawsuit on his hands from the owner of those hogs. And so he has to be property protected from that.
Right. In our area, like the poultry companies, they own the birds. And, you know, they just
yeah.
hire the
yeah.
growers to grow them and pay them X dollars for
Yep, that's exactly what I'm talking about
yeah.
here. But
yeah.
So that grower has... You know, he's got responsibility if he does something negligent and causes those animals to die.
Right. Okay, I want to shift gears just a hair here, just on, not in crops now, okay? Vacant
okay.
land. You know, we sell a lot of recreational land in
yeah.
our area. And would a person buying 50, 100, it doesn't matter what it is, but, you know, investing their hard-earned dollars in land they want to hunt on or four-wheel on or camp on or raise their kids on camping, I don't mean full time, but I'm just saying recreational land. Do I need insurance, and why?
Yeah, you know that. Yeah, the answer is yes. Anytime you own land, you have the risk of somebody getting injured on that land. Even if it's a trespasser, you can, in some cases, be held responsible for that. So if you had a hazard out there, let's say you dug a hole, maybe you were going to do some work, you left that hole unattended, and a trespasser comes through and falls in the hole, you can still be held liable for that. So you do need liability insurance. That is not very expensive. That's a very inexpensive type of insurance to buy.
What kind of dollars are you looking at? I know this is kind of varies, but just, I mean.
For 100 acres, you might be looking at $100 a year.
Yeah, okay.
To have liability insurance on that.
Wow.
And then the hunting, I'm glad you mentioned that, too, because it's getting popular in our area to do hunting leases.
Uh-huh.
So you own the land, but you lease it out to maybe a group of guys that can come in, that you allow to come in and hunt. Or you might lease it to an outfitter, and the outfitter then will charge people to come in and hunt.
Right.
So that's a little bit more complicated, a lot more exposure there, a lot more chance of somebody getting injured. So you need special insurance for that.
And that could be relatively expensive? You're talking about $100 on a...
If you lease your land out to an outfitter, it's pretty common that the outfitter would carry the insurance and name you as an insured on his policy.
Okay.
In that case, it's going to, probably at no cost to you. If you have a relatively small hunting exposure where you're, maybe taking in less than $5,000 a year from leasing out individual hunting rights, that's pretty inexpensive too, just a few $100, $200-$300.
Okay, so it's still reasonable.
Yeah.
Okay. What about vacant insurance? I've got a second home. Or farm, hobby farm, but I live in town. That's a different type of insurance as well, right?
Yeah, and that's getting more difficult all the time. I tell you, with the mold issue is something that has insurance companies very cautious.
I'm sure.
I can remember when I started in this business 37 years ago, if you had a water line in the house break, you went in with a shop vac and backed up the water and put some fans on it, and everything was good. Well, today when that happens, everybody's afraid of mold. Mold inside the walls. We have our environmental companies that come in, and it's extremely expensive to remediate that.
Yes, it is.
So for that reason, insurance companies are really hesitant to insure a vacant home. Mostly, for a lot of reasons, but the water problem is a big one.
Right.
If a water pipe broke in your house, you're going to find it within a few hours, probably. In a vacant home, it could be weeks before that broken water line is discovered.
Well, we see that.
By that time, there could be so much water in there that the house could be literally totaled.
Yeah, John, we see that a lot in the residential. People, they move out of their home, put it up for sale, it's vacant, and they can't get insurance, because it's not being occupied.
Yeah, you're right.
So,
There are some companies that specialize in offering the vacant property insurance. So you can find them, but you're going to pay a lot more for it, too.
Right. So we've covered pretty much my notes here. You said you had made a few things you wanted to talk about. Let's use the next seven minutes, if you'd like to, bring up some other observations about insurance and why we need it.
All right. So I talked about, we talked about the diversification with farming and getting crossing the line from farming into business pursuits. Another thing we're seeing in Illinois is, which is kind of on that line, is wind turbines. Do you have some of those out there?
No, we don't. Maybe up the coast, but not in North
Carolina. Companies are coming through and offering to put wind turbines leasing land off farm owners to put up wind turbines. So the farm owner's not operating the turbine, but it's located on his land, and he gets paid, so much a year to have it on there. So that's another exposure that needs to be addressed with their liability insurance. Somebody gets injured on that turbine, kids out there, playing, trying to climb up it. Again, crop dusters can get tangled up trying to crop dust the farms and get tangled up in the turbine. So that's something to be aware of. That you need to address with your liability insurance if you're in that situation. We also see, of course, cellular towers, same thing. They pay you to put a cell tower out on the farm.
Right.
You need to make sure you have liability on that. People are oftentimes putting their farms into a trust, and which is a great estate planning tool. They have to remember, though, that the trust, the owner, the title holder of the land needs to be protected. Now it's no longer an individual owner. It's a trust as an owner. So they have to address that with their liability insurance as well.
What other type of insurance that we haven't talked about?
Well, we touched on liability to farm employees and work comp.
Right.
I wanted to maybe expand on that a little
bit.
Yeah,
please.
So if you're in, especially I'm going to talk about Illinois, I guess, here.
Yeah, no, that's
not
fine.
Required, if you're under the exemption, so you've got less than four full-time employees, so you're not required by the state to have work comp. But you still have employees. Let's say you have one or two full-time employees. So there's a risk that one of those employees are going to get hurt. So there's two ways to address that. One is, even though you're not required to have work comp, you still can carry work comp on them. Or the alternative to that is have liability coverage endorsed onto your farm owner's policy to cover liability to farm employees. Now, there's pros and cons of either way. The nice thing about work comp is it's unlimited. You can never run out of coverage. It doesn't matter if the employee is severely injured, paralyzed, disabled the rest of his life. You know, the claim could reach $2, $3, $4, $5, $8 million. Who knows how high it could go?
Right.
With work comp, you can't. It'll pay whatever it takes. Can't run out of a limit. If you're just addressing that exposure through your liability, then you know, you're going to have a limit on your policy. You might have a $1 million limit or $2 million or three. Some of them have $5 million. But when that limit is reached, then you're out of coverage.
Right. So like car insurance.
Yeah, like car insurance. Exactly. Right. So then you have to. So work comp is by far a better option. However, it's more expensive. So that's another business decision people have to decide.
How much more percentage-wise? Is it 50% more, 20% more?
Oh, no. It would be 10 times.
Oh, wow. Okay. So it is expensive.
Yeah. It is expensive, yeah.
Yeah. So many people opt into that, or is that that's for the rich?
Yeah, there's a fair amount of people who opt into it, but I would say not the majority, maybe 20%, 20-25% do. The other thing is to look out for, you know, as I said, farm operations have an exemption from work comp in Illinois. But when you start crossing the line into other businesses, if you're doing trucking for hire,
uh-huh.
Say you have three trucks,
right.
Three semis, you know, and you're hauling your grain, but also to keep those trucks busy, you're hauling other grain for hire. Well, while that employee's hauling for hire, he's not in a farming operation, so you've lost your exemption at that point.
I gotcha.
And you'd be required to have work comp on him at that point.
An unusual situation, but I'm sure it's out there.
It's out there a lot, yeah.
Yeah, no, but I'm just saying another situation, John. I own a 1,000-acre farm, okay? And 80% of it's in one state and 20% of it's in another state, but it's contiguous.
Yeah.
Like taxes, you know, if I own land in North Carolina and part of it's in Virginia, but 90% of it's in North Carolina taxes me in the county and Virginia gets nothing. Is insurance kind of work the same way?
You know, that's not really a big issue for insurance because most of the liability insurance policies will cover anything in the United States.
Okay.
In the territory of the United States.
Gotcha. So, like, if you own multiple farms in multiple states, you could probably have one policy for the...
Yeah, you could. You could.
Yeah. Okay, that's good.
So that's not a big problem.
Gotcha. So, just with about 4 or 5 minutes left here, what else you want to talk about with insurance? Or do you want to switch and tell us about land and land prices and your land industry and your beautiful state?
That'd be a good topic. So,
because you're a real estate agent too. You're a realtor and an ALC. So tell us about your state and what's going on with land out there.
Okay. So we, as I mentioned earlier in the show, our local Realtors Land Institute chapter, along with the Illinois Society of Farm Managers and Rural Appraisers, we jointly produce a land values book every year, and I'm on one of the committees to help produce that book. So,
and I get a copy of that every year. Thank you. You do a great job with it.
Okay, great. I didn't know you were getting that out there.
Yes,
so,
sir.
You know, land. in 2019 in Illinois, it was a tough year for farmers. The weather was terrible. There was a lot of preventive planting. It was wet. It was late getting in. Then, you know, we had these trade wars going on, the tariffs, and prices were not good. Yields were not good. We really expected going into fall is when, you know, that's when most of the farms sell in this area after harvest. So in November, December, I would say probably 75 or 80% of the farms that move do so in November, December. So going into that with all these problems in 2019 in the ag sector, we were really expecting to see land prices go down, and they didn't. For the good land, it was virtually level with last year, with right. 2018.
And you guys sell, you sell your farms by soil types, by Class A, Class B, Class C, right?
Yeah.
And that has a direct effect on the value.
Correct, yeah. Now in our area, the majority of the farmland, and I'm talking about, you know, good farmland that's mostly row crop production, is going to be sold by public auction. How about out there, Lou? What's the method normally used out there to sell?
We see some auctions, but most of it's just traded through brokers, or actually for sale by owners, because the farmers network, and you know, someone dies and it's in an estate, and they know about it, and you know, usually it's promised to the buddy down the road that's helped the family for 100 years. You know, so it's more inside trading. We do see some auctions, though, and you guys provide an auction service, too, in your company, right?
Yes, our company, we do an auction service. We did start doing that about 15 years ago because that was a preferred way of the market was demanding it.
Right. We just got our auction license, too, so North Carolina, last November. So I've done probably about 40 that I co-list with Dale Fult with Rogers Realty and Auction, who's an ALC. And also a CAI. So we've done quite a few where I've got clients, and, you know, it needs to be auctioned. So I'll get Dale involved. We'll co-broker it, and been very successful. So, but now we have our own company license, which I'm excited about.
Yeah, great.
So what else is going on in real estate there with just a couple minutes here? Looking for a good year this year?
Farm incomes are down this year. Farm leases are pretty much level from going into 20, with level of what they were in 19. You know, there's still a lot of competition to lease farmland. So although the farm incomes are down and the farm operators would like to see a lower rent, the landlords just aren't willing to do it, and the rents are holding steady.
But we've got these new trade deals, too, and that's looking very positive for the future, I think.
Yeah.
I think the farmers are pretty excited about that. And there was some bailout for the farmers that the federal government created last year, too, that hopefully kept a few of them.
And a lot of them are saying that market facilitation program was their profit. Everything else broke even.
It's okay. It was a lifesaver, and it was very timely.
Yep.
So our government does provide things to help, so believe it or not, so that's good. So, all right, well, start giving us some information about you and your company and how we get in touch with you, and we'll close this thing out.
Sure. Lou said, my name is John Leezer. It's Leezer. We're in Tulane, Illinois, which is central Illinois. I've been in business 37 years. My dad started it. Our agency has been in the family for 50 years. I'm an accredited land consultant. I'm a certified insurance counselor. Our business is focused around agriculture, and my phone number is 309-286-2221.
What's your email address?
My email address is John, J-O-H-N, at leezeragency.com, and that's LEEZERAGENCY.com.
And the name of you have a couple companies. Name of your companies?
Mike, I have Leezer Insurance Agency, and then I have John Leezer Farmland Sales.
Okay. So stay with us, John. You've been a great guest. I'm going to close this out with Rodney here, so hang on.
Okay.
So thank you for joining us today. Let us know how you like the show. If you have any guests or topics you would like to suggest, we would appreciate them. All questions are welcomed, and all of our guests may be emailed with your questions or concerns as well. This show is for the public, but most importantly for real estate agents who do not have a source of land education. We are the free land education show. All of our shows after they're broadcast this morning will be downloaded on our master website, which is www.letstalkland.net. That's L-E-T-S, no apostrophe, talkland.net. Also, they're downloaded on Podbeam and Spotify. My email is Lou, L-O-U, at mylandpro.com. My cell number is 336-669-1405. Rodney, how do they get in touch with the station here?
Well, they can go to our website, Lou. They can go to WKTE1090.com, click on our website, and also we have a simple radio app that they can download.
It's just a simple app, huh?
Simple radio app. That's
But that's
it.
The name of it,
that's
right?
It. That's
okay.
It. Okay. Yeah.
And we've been, we're beach music and oldies, and we only play happy music.
Happy music. If you want to hear sad music and everything, you got to tune to somebody else.
That's right. We want them. Okay. And we've won some awards that have been nominated.
Yeah, 5 years in a row for being the best top beach music and oldies station on the East Coast.
That's why we play happy music.
That's
Everybody
right.
appreciates it.
Everybody loves it.
And you got a nice award last year.
Yes, it was the Reader's Choice Award for the Announcer of the Year 2019.
Imagine that.
Yes, and you're going to be here next year, maybe. In the running.
I am?
Probably.
What?
Yeah.
No way. How about Shada?
Shada might get in there.
Shada, you want to get an award? Hey, George, you being on the show today, and John, and this is Let's Talk Land. Stay tuned for Dr. Barbie.